From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Dorian is along the Florida coast, now a Category 2 storm, weakened since it parked over and laid bare islands of the Bahamas. But the National Hurricane Center is still warning of life-threatening storm surges here in the U.S. People are evacuating up the coast to North Carolina. Keep an ear on the news. Meanwhile, we're starting to see Dorian's wake on the islands of Abaco and Grand Bahama. Seven people are confirmed dead in the Bahamas. That number is expected to rise. Last night, Bahamian Prime Minister Hubert Minnis called it the greatest national crisis in our country's history. Let's bring in Bahamian Senator Fred Mitchell in Nassau on the island of New Providence. Senator Mitchell, relief efforts are being staged from Nassau. What are you hearing?
Well, people are understandably stunned. The historians tell us that the last time anything like this occurred in the Bahamas was back in 1932. And so no one in living memory has any idea of the kind of destruction that a hurricane of this force can bring.
Well, we're hearing about entire communities, 2,000 Haitian migrants who are living in very, kind of flimsy housing. All that housing is gone, so there's a question about where
everything
people are.
Everything is wiped out. It's just an amazing scene to see.
Well, how do you start helping? Because we also understand the national airport in Abaco is underwater.
This morning I got a briefing from the police, and they say that the airport at Treasure Key is now open. That's an 8,000-foot runway. That's also an international port. Treasure Key is about 30 minutes drive up from Marsh Harbor. The Marsh Harbor airport is still covered in water, but Treasure Key is now receded, and so it's able to take flights. The problem is, of course, the roads are still blocked.
Well, the roads are blocked, and so we understand that people are traveling on jet skis. We were reading an account of somebody in a huge backhoe who cradled some children in the backhoe so that the big wheels of the backhoe could ride them through some flooded waters. I mean, people are going in and making rescues, but
in Grand Bahama, people are just holding their breaths, really, that it comes out okay, because people were trapped in their ceilings as the waters started to rise, and it was difficult with the winds to be able to do anything to mount a rescue. So it's just simply harrowing.
People there are saying this is the Bahamas Katrina. You mentioned people trapped in attics. You know, now people in New Orleans have axes in their attics so that they can get out when the water rises.
You know, we got a briefing, I guess, on Friday afternoon, because you have some experts in here from Hawaii who have been working in with the Bahamas over a number of years on storm preparation. And they did the scenarios for us that it was going to be catastrophic and that it would take days, not hours, to start mounting rescues. And sure enough, that's what it's proven. So the Prime Minister said last night that obviously we have to look at the codes, we have to look at our procedures, we have to look at the issues of climate change in order to see how we plan for the future.
Yeah.
But of course, the immediate future now is to try and rescue those who are in need of help. We've had a lot of support from our CARICOM partners. The United States government has been most helpful in trying to mobilize quickly, and of people who are Americans who know Abaco quite well and Grand Bahama, and of course are coming to the rescue.
Well, not only that, Senator, you have a lot of Bahamians living here in the U.S. I'm sure you're hearing from them. I'm sure they're desperate to hear from family members.
That's right. I mean, there are a lot of calls are going out. I think I mentioned to Ambassador Sidney Poitier, who's a great fan of NPR. He's one of the Bahamians who lives over there. And you've got Clay Thompson, you've got Michael Thompson, you've got Buddy Heald. All of these are athletes. And then, of course, you've got a huge community in Miami and Atlanta and New York, and everybody sort of mobilizing to try and get support over here very quickly.
And try to get word. When do you think the communications will be up? Because that's been so painful for people. They just don't know how their loved ones are.
That's right. Abaco is going to be a little down the road because I think the towers were compromised. So that's a little bit more difficult. The police communication has been restored, and there is some telecommunications contact with Grand Bahama.
So still holding your breath there to see, what the human loss is.
That's right. You know, property you can replace, but human lives, that's a whole other thing. And I think no one properly anticipated the strength and the vigor that this storm brought to the Bahamas. Nassau is still operational. People here had a lot of flooding, but, this is the engine of the country, and you know, we can get back up and running more quickly, and that provides the impetus to rescue our brethren and sisters who are in Abaco and in Grand Bahama.
Well, I hear something else you're saying there, Senator. If somebody's planned a winter trip to Nassau in the Bahamas, go, because Nassau needs you to come.
Amen. Amen. This is still paradise.
Senator Fred Mitchell, thank you so much.
Blessings.
Well, it is another dramatic day in Britain's House of Commons. Lawmakers are debating a bill that would stop Prime Minister Boris Johnson from taking the UK out of the European Union without a deal. If they pass that bill, Johnson plans to call a snap election. Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. He's at Westminster. Rob, what's happening today?
What is happening today? Well, I suppose I should set the scene a bit. The man who won the Vote Leave referendum in 2016 by promising to take back control, namely Boris Johnson, he's lost somewhat control of the Brexit process, because we saw this at the beginning of a move last night by Conservative and other MPs, opposition MPs, to stop the possibility of Britain leaving the European Union without a deal at the end of October. And we're going to see further progress towards turning that into law. So what that means is that Boris Johnson's pledge, the great pledge that he made when he became Prime Minister and leader of the Conservative Party, I will have Brexit do or die at the end of October, that is now much more difficult for him. And he can only do it by either getting a deal with the European Union between now and the end of October, which looks sort of unlikely, or, drumroll, holding a general election here in the UK between now and the end of October, winning it and overturning any law that rules out a no deal.
So is that the most likely outcome now, that there will be another election? And how does that happen so quickly?
I think it's absolutely the most likely outcome, because the government no longer has a working majority. And of course, with an issue as complex as Brexit, my goodness, you need all the people on your side you can get. The real question, I think, is just when that general election is going to be. Boris Johnson would like it to be sooner rather than later, on October the 15th, so he could still say, I'm going to be the one who's going to deliver Brexit by the end of October. The opposition Labour Party is a bit more split on the issue. There are some who think, given the chaos in British politics, it would look sort of cynical if you put off an election much beyond that. Others thinking, hang on a minute, what would be really smart was to make sure that we get past October the 31st, that you don't have a no-deal Brexit, and then why not have an election shortly after that, which would also have the merit of, as one senior Labour politician put it here, allowing Mr Johnson to stew in his own juices and the failure to bring Brexit on the 31st of October. Now, what happens about this date, I think it's going to become clear in the next, I don't know, 2, 3, 4, 5 days.
Rob, I've been listening to a lot of Brexit coverage over the last couple of days. A lot of you on all kinds of BBC platforms. But one of the things that I've heard from people who are against Brexit is they've started to make this argument that even if the country were to leave with no deal on the 31st of October, that is just going to be the start of a long negotiation of how to have a trade relationship with Europe in the future. Is that resonating, that people who think, oh, let's just get it over with, be done with Brexit, that they're starting to think, well, maybe that wouldn't be the end of Brexit even if we did leave?
Okay, two quick points. I mean, that is absolutely correct. I mean, you know, anyone who thinks that leaving with no deal, let's say it right, we just get on with being good old Britain again, and what, that's just absolutely wouldn't happen. I mean, one could imagine that Britain's future relationship with the European Union would be the dominant issue in British politics for years and years and years to come. But the other part of your question, is it resonating? You see, everything in this country, Jeremy, is split now, entirely polarised along Remain Leave lines. So if you're a Remainer, you hear that argument and you go, yeah, of course, no deal is bonkers, for goodness sake, Brexit is rubbish. If you're a Brexiteer, if you were a Leave voter, you just tend to just tune all of that stuff out and say, no, let's just get on with Brexit, for goodness sake, that's what we voted for. And that, of course, is why this country is in the most almighty mess, because people are deeply polarised, and there's absolutely no sign among any of the politicians, political parties or political movements of thinking a way of how on earth do you stitch this country back together and somehow deal with Brexit.
Rob, one more thing. Tell us what's going on behind you.
So what's going on behind me? I mean, I was always told when I first joined, when I first became a political journalist, one of my bosses at the BBC said, the thing about Britain, Rob, is that people just aren't in the slightest bit interested in politics, unlike in other European countries like France. And I said, yeah, well, that's great, isn't it? I mean, that's good to be in a country like that. Brexit, of course, has ended all of that. And we, every day is like a sort of, I don't know, it's like a kind of medieval carnival here outside Parliament. I'm looking now on all these people with flags. There's some guy with a, I don't know where he got it. It's the biggest megaphone you've ever seen. And he goes, stop Brexit now. And then you have the Vote Leave lot tooting if you want to vote Leave. There's a guy, when you come onto, there's a special sort of place outside Parliament for the journalists. There's a guy there telling everyone that, you know, they need to start thinking about God. I mean, you name it, we got it all going on here, Jeremy. It's apocalyptic.
That's BBC political correspondent Rob Watson at Westminster. Rob, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Let's continue our conversation now with Mike Isaac, author of the new book, Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber, which is out this week. Isaac is a technology reporter for the New York Times. He's covered Uber since 2014, and he's chronicled how its founder's confrontational style fostered a toxic culture that eventually led to his ouster. Mike Isaac, let's talk about Travis Kalanick. He got a 1580 on his SAT, you're right. I mean, he's a very smart guy. It's almost a perfect score back in those days. And he apparently just had the best pitch to investors. He was able to just walk in and get them to just hand over millions of dollars. And in the case of Google Ventures, almost $300 million.
That's right. I mean, you know, there's this obsession in the Valley with Steve Jobs and this sort of showman-like pitch. But anyone who's ever met Travis Kalanick knows he really is a true polished showman. He knew how to come in and dazzle potential investors with the rocket ship growth that Uber had early on. And so he and his business partner, Emil Michael, eventually set up what they called the home show. With IPOs, there's a roadshow where companies will pitch themselves to investors. Instead, they flipped that on its head and had investors come to Uber to beg to be let into the funding rounds. And it worked. There were, you know, from mutual funds to giants of private equity to VCs, everyone was just fighting to get into this company, which kept raising money after round until it hit a $68.5 billion private valuation, which is one of the highest in private tech companies ever.
Okay, so he was very good at raising money, but also, as you point out, and as we now know because of the reporting that's been done about Travis Kalanick, he set this tone at the company that was really unhealthy and looked the other way. Yeah. Usually when one of the people beneath him would get into trouble, either with sexual harassment or whatever the case might be, the message was, as long as they're performing well, I don't care.
Yeah, that's right. I think Uber's DNA from the beginning is to win at all costs, to keep your numbers up and to keep growing. Now, what sort of went by the wayside is worrying about how a culture was built, if we can sort of build actual HR systems or practices that would like make people feel like they're not going to get harassed or have a coffee mug thrown at them or have their manager hit on them on their first day of work or whatever. And those weren't really things that leaders at the company put first. It was really always about not feeling like a bloated sort of corporate giant that Travis didn't want the company to be. And while it kept Uber scrappy and lean and able to grow quickly, I think it also came with a lot of side effects that caught up to them in a big way in 2017 as one scandal after another kept breaking.
As the scandals broke and as Travis Kalanick sort of got deeper and deeper into a hole, he relied a lot on Arianna Huffington, who's on the board of Uber. How did that relationship come about and why is she so important to him and to Uber?
Yeah, so Arianna is a fascinating character in this book and I think in, you know, public life too. And she has always managed to kind of find the next trend that is coming up. You know, she was politics early on and then went into digital media with the Huffington Post and then found Uber. So she's always seemed to find like what is around the next corner. And she did that with Uber really well and attached to Travis and became this sort of very trusted figure in his inner circle and ultimately gained a board seat. Later on in Uber's history, and as I talk about in the book, there's a pretty brutal board fight where they're trying to remove Travis from the top of the company as CEO. And he felt very close to Arianna as one of the people in his on his side, right? And I think she really saw in him like the good qualities that Travis has, and his willingness to fight, his willingness to be a powerful entrepreneur and lead his people. And sometimes, you know, probably thought the good qualities outweighed the bad ones. So she becomes a really important ally to him in this book. And I don't want to spoil what actually ends up happening between the two, but she is an important figure.
There was a really interesting fight that Kalanick had with Apple, maybe we could just call it a meeting at a certain point. But basically, Uber was doing something that it shouldn't have been doing with data that was available to them in the beginning on the iPhone. Explain what happened. This is about IMEI numbers.
Sure. So this goes back to some of the problems that Uber has had in China. There was a big fraud activity problem. Uber needed to find a way to spot fraudsters. So what they would do is use the specific number called the IMEI, essentially an identification number on each iPhone. And they use this service to fingerprint each iPhone. So even if a fraudster wiped the iPhone and re-signed up to do another scam, Uber was able to use that fingerprint and identify it and then block them from the service. Mm-hmm. That seems totally fair game, and it was even a novel way of figuring out how to solve this fraud problem. But the other problem was that eventually fingerprinting became something that was against Apple's rules. It's Apple's big on privacy, as you probably hear the CEO talk about a lot. And so fingerprinting devices and attaching identity to a device after it's been wiped is not cool with Apple. So eventually Uber was caught doing that even after the rules had changed, and had to come in for a very tense meeting between Eddie Q, who heads up iTunes and a lot of cloud services, and then Tim Cook, Apple CEO himself.
And they said basically, if you ever do this again, we're going to take you off the App Store, which is like you can't operate as Uber without access to the App Store.
I mean, imagine everyone who has an iPhone not being able to use Uber now. That's right. Just a death blow to the company.
But they didn't do it. That's the interesting thing, is that they just let him off with a warning, basically.
I mean, the leverage that I would say that Uber has is that a lot of people use the service, and it's a key component for a long time of why people wanted iPhones, especially when it's an iPhone-only app. That's the sort of delicate dance that Apple has to deal with sometimes when apps are so powerful that it's hard for them to even discipline them when they're breaking the rules.
What finally got Kalanick out?
You know, I think it was years of turning his head on a lot of practices that were simmering under the surface in the company, whether it was like cultural issues or harassment, or whether it was questionable business practices that, you know, may have broken some laws, depending on your argument. I think also, you know, I go over this in the book, but like 2016, 2017 is this real year of reckoning for tech companies, mm-hmm. where, say, the past 15, 20 years of coverage has largely been in awe of founders who build these giant machines of capital creation. And I think something changed in the past 2 years where folks are starting to recognize the negative effects that tech might have on the world. And maybe automation might be stealing jobs at some point. Or maybe if these self-driving cars become a real thing, you know, drivers are thrown by the wayside. Or maybe we're being manipulated through Facebook and don't even know it. And I think Uber was at the nexus of this flashpoint of anger for a lot of people. And especially with all the baggage that it had, it just came to bear at the exact wrong time for Travis Kalanick.
Well, and of all those companies, Uber has so much data on its users and where they're going at all times.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, and this is the thing that I think catches the tech industry at large off guard, is that they've been collecting information on how we live and operate and move through the world for years, and no one has really bristled at it until now. And so now companies, all companies, but especially Uber, they have to scramble to figure out how can we do this in an ethical way while still maintaining our business model. It's a fine line, and I think every company right now is sort of struggling to figure that out.
What does the rise of Uber and then the fall of Kalanick tell you about the American economy right now?
I mean, look, I think Uber did pioneer this category in how people not only move around, but just how labor works, how services work, how we can get things from just a tap of a smartphone. But I also think with that comes a lot of really thorny ideas about what employment looks like, what labor models and protections should be. You know, I think workers are upset that with the rise of the gig economy, we're starting to lose some of these fundamental protections that have been fought for a very long time. And it's going to take years to sort of play out whether we're okay with how that works and how that's created this new form of industry.
Do you think there will be taxis in 10 years?
I think if there are, they're going to look very different. They're going to have to look very different and probably need to get connected to a smartphone app at least much, much, much easier.
Do people tell you that they think that Uber has the future that it would have had if Kalanick had stayed? Because obviously there's a reason he was able to last as long as he did. People saw a vision in him and thought he was driving Uber basically in the right direction.
Yeah.
Does it have that now without him?
You know, it's really funny. I was talking to someone earlier about this. The 2017, they just needed someone to come in and put the fires out in the building because the baggage that came with Travis's leadership was weighing the company down. Now we're 2 years into Dara Khosrowshahi's reign. He's the new CEO. He's been called the dad of Silicon Valley, and the company is pretty boring right now. And some argued that's what Uber needed, at least for a period of time. But then some are also, you know, saying, well, we kind of missed that fire that Travis had. That was what motivated employees to grow the company and conquer the world so quickly, you know. So I do wonder what the future of Uber is going to be like, if it's going to be an Amazon, as they keep saying that they want it to be, a transportation platform, or if it's going to be a more middling company like eBay where, you know, it might sort of chug along but is far from the world-dominating platform that they once thought it would be.
That is Mike Isaac, whose new book is called Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber. Mike Isaac, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And you can find an excerpt from the book and listen to the rest of my interview with Mike Isaac at hereandnow.org. Airlines have been pushing back the date when the Boeing 737 MAX 8s will return to the sky. Last week, United Airlines said the plane won't fly again until mid-December. American Airlines made a similar announcement over the weekend. The MAX 8 was grounded worldwide this year after two fatal crashes killed 346 people. Our transportation analyst Seth Kaplan sat down this morning with Oscar Munoz, the CEO of United Airlines. And Seth, does he think people will be willing to trust the plane again as early as December?
He said he'll be on the first flight because I asked him, what's that going to look like? Passengers, employees. And he said, look, he'll be there. He knows that it'll be a highly covered event. And he did confirm, by the way, Jeremy, that United will give people the option to not fly on that flight or on other early MAX flights, you know, understanding that there are some people who just aren't going to want to be on those early flights, even though, as you would expect, he emphasized that United's not going to fly the plane until it's certain that it's safe to do so.
Is he pretty confident about that mid-December?
Well, he emphasized that safety's first. So, you know, they have the plane back in the schedule then because they think that that's reasonable. But I think that they're simply not taking the plane out of the plane beyond then because they know that it's early enough that if you kind of do these rolling cancellations several months out, flights just aren't booked all that full. And if you do have to take the plane out, you can go ahead and put passengers on other flights. It's a lot more work to take it out and then put it back in later than it is to just kind of leave it in when you know that it's just not all that disruptive if you have to make a change.
What did he say about the big picture of air travel? Because despite the two crashes and the groundings, last year U.S. Airlines carried a record 889 million passengers. Demand has been outpacing economic expansion for years. How optimistic is Munoz about growth, especially if there is a slowdown in the global economy?
And interestingly, just today, JetBlue came out with a rather bearish investor update. Now, they blamed some of their issues on things that are more specific to JetBlue. They have a lot of exposure to the Southeast. The Dorian cancellations impact them more than most airlines. But they also mentioned just some system-wide weakness. United reaffirmed their current expectations, which are rather optimistic right now. And Munoz said also today that they haven't seen any need so far to revise that. So different airlines seeing different things. even as the global economy rather clearly is wobbling, and questions too, as you said, Jeremy, about the U.S. economy as the trade war continues.
Seth, how is United going to respond to this growing movement of people who are more and more concerned about their carbon footprint when they fly? We just saw the 16-year-old activist Greta Thunberg make headlines when she took a boat to a UN summit instead of flying there. People are very aware of this. Are they going to respond?
And you have KLM, the Dutch European airline, telling people, maybe think about not flying, maybe take the train. I asked Munoz about that, and he was about as animated as I've seen an airline executive in saying that absolutely climate change is real and we all have to do something about it, including United Airlines. Interestingly, he dismissed KLM's move as a gimmick. He said that doesn't solve anything. He said we're an airline, we fly, and we need to make fundamental changes, new aircraft technology, better procedures, and all of these sorts of things. So very much embracing climate change as an imminent issue for the planet and recognizing the airline's role in it.
That is Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
About the grounded Boeing 737 MAX jet with the faulty software that made the nose point down no matter what the pilots did. As we just heard, the planes may be back in the air by December with new software from Boeing and training for pilots. 2 weeks ago, there was reporting that the FAA would let the grounded planes back by October. We spoke then with Michael Stumo and Nadia Milleron, parents of 24-year-old Samia Stumo, one of 157 killed on Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 when it crashed after takeoff in Ethiopia, just 5 months after the crash of Lion Air Flight 610 in Indonesia. The parents were adamant October was too soon to bring the MAX 737 back. Now, they say December makes more sense, but they're wary. Michael Stumo and Nadia Milleron have also joined other family members in filing a lawsuit against Boeing for what they say is the wrongful death of their daughter. They say it was known the planes were faulty. Let's check in with them. Michael, Nadia, I can't even imagine how you feel when I say the flight number. So thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it still continues to be awful reality that we can't quite even come to terms with.
I know. And there's two things going on here. Your campaign now is to make sure nobody else goes through this. And you wrote this, Nadia, in a piece for CNN. You want to make sure all the investigations have been completed, including an independent study ordered by the Transportation Secretary, Elaine Chao, and a grand jury investigation conducted by the Department of Justice. The FAA knew there was a problem after the first crash in Indonesia, just like Boeing seemed to know that there was an issue and didn't tell the pilots or all the pilots how to overcome it. What do you think should happen?
We should leave no stone unturned. So what we learned is that there are parts of this plane that never had to be reviewed that are ancient. The 1967 type certificate that this plane has. These have only been amended type certificates that have occurred all the way since 1967. So you have parts of the plane which are not at all up to the safety standard of 2019. So for example, there's only one sensor for a float in the fuel tank, which if that sensor failed, then the fuel tank could overflow and then there would be fuel everywhere and that would be a fire hazard. So these are huge issues.
Well, and you and other families have become activists. You've tried to talk to officials, including Ali Bahrami. He's the new head of safety for the FAA, an engineer, but also a longtime industry executive. What happened?
Ali Bahrami spoke at a Senate hearing on the last day of July, and we were involved in a documentary film production about my daughter's life. And when we were exhausted and finished with the day of filming and we were having our supper, I looked at my phone and my phone was blowing up. There were messages from all of the 64 families that we're in touch with, families of the victims in the crash, saying, who is this guy, Ali Bahrami? He just admitted this morning in his Senate testimony that he knew there was a problem. So I thought, and all the families thought, that admitting that in front of the Senate should immediately get him fired.
That was the testimony where he suggested that the pilots were culpable in the crashes. He had to pull that back because, of course, the pilots said, wait a second, we were not informed.
So we saw the testimony on YouTube. Then we decided to drive to D.C. to answer him. We got there early in the morning. We started calling the press. We called our liaison at the FAA to tell him we were coming. They tried to make a meeting with Ali Bahrami and us instead of protesting because we can explain his comments. I said, his comments are his comments. They don't need explaining. Then we did go into his office at 3 p.m. And the lack of thinking about what the FAA could do better in the future was unbelievable. The man is as hard-boiled as they come. And he continued on like that with my son saying, Mr. Bahrami, with 2020 vision, looking back at the Indonesian crash, what could the FAA have done to prevent the crash in Ethiopia? He said, nothing. We could have done nothing to prevent the crash. Then we said, what does the FAA need to be able to prevent such crashes? He said, we're all set. We said, well, we understand that software. You don't have engineers to do software analysis. He said, oh, well, that's a matter of the market. There's not enough aviation software engineers to fill all the jobs available. And I said, well, don't you think you could make a call out there and say, we've got to have these software engineers or we can't certify planes that have software that needs analysis? It was a horrifying conversation in terms of what it revealed about the agency and how they talk to us like they're Boeing. They said, we were disappointed that we couldn't get the planes back up in the summer. Why would the FAA, a safety agency, be disappointed about that? When Ted Cruz said three times in our discussion with him that the FAA is a captured agency, this is what he means. And we can't just accept that.
You know, it just strikes me. It's just horrifying that you have to have a loss. And then you have to be the voices to try to make sure that nobody else has a loss. And maybe seeing your daughter here, can you tell us a little bit about her? She sounded pretty extraordinary. She wasn't just on a plane. She was flying from Ethiopia to Kenya for her first assignment with a developmental organization, a health system?
Global health, a global health organization, a nonprofit.
Yeah, tell us about it, Michael.
She was amazing. She taught herself to read at age 4. She was raising pigs at age 7. She was driving a dump truck around our farm at age 10. She went to school for college for a year at age 14. Went to Peru, did some field research for University of Massachusetts during a program there and got involved in global health issues and wrote an academic poster as a young undergrad, won a national award, the competition at the American Anthropology Association. She ended up getting a full-ride scholarship to the University of Copenhagen School of Global Health, graduated from there, one of their most published graduates and master's program, and got a job with ThinkWell in Washington, D.C., which did bottom-up, patient-centered change-type work in global health as opposed to top-down that would have effects on patients that they don't often detect. And so ThinkWell had a program funded by the Gates Foundation to do global health work in East Africa. They needed to set up some offices. Samuel was 2 months into the job and was assigned to go and help set up the offices. It's a job. She was so mature, not only in intelligence sense, but she was, you know, socially mature and charismatic. Usually they don't have someone do that kind of job, work with local governments and businesses to set up offices until you're, you know, in your 30s. But she was deemed mature enough to that she should lead it. Of course, we wish she hadn't. And that's where she was headed. So she texted us when she was on layover in Addis Ababa, said, "I'm about to get on the plane on the way to Nairobi," and she never made it.
A terrible loss for us all, and multiplied by all the other victims. Nadia, you are understandably angry. You want things to change. What's the one thing you would tell people that they could do to be a part of your effort?
They should contact the aviation subcommittees for the House and the Senate and demand that Boeing testify and demand that the Congress put pressure on the FAA so that they don't put the planes back into service until they have found out all this information.
That's Nadia Milleron, along with Michael Stumo, parents of 24-year-old Samia Stumo, one of the 157 people killed on Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 last March. And they've also filed a lawsuit, as others have. Nadia, Michael, please keep us posted, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The governor of Michigan announced today that she has ordered the state's health department to issue emergency rules to ban the sale and marketing of flavored nicotine vaping products. Governor Gretchen Whitmer says Michigan will be the first state to do so. The ban will include mint and menthol, as well as fruity flavors like strawberry milk, peach madness, and an e-cigarette pod that is supposed to taste like Fruit Loops. The governor says she's instituting the ban to keep kids safe. Well, when you hear the name O'Keeffe, it's not a doubt that it's Georgia O'Keeffe who pops into your mind. Her pastel-colored flowers and desert landscapes are iconic. But there was more than one driven artist in the O'Keeffe family. Andrea Shea of member station WBUR reports on the sleuthing it took to build an exhibition around the lesser-known O'Keeffe, Ida.
Dick Diamond and his wife are huge fans of Georgia O'Keeffe.
I mean, we went through all the O'Keeffe stuff, her home and so on, and but I don't remember reading about her sister there.
The couple is at the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, Massachusetts, where an exhibition about Ida O'Keeffe just opened. Another visitor, Marvin Cooper, recalls reading something somewhere about George's sister.
It was totally a shock that she existed.
Why haven't we ever heard of her?
That's what curator Sue Canterbury asked back in 2013 when she looked across a room in an art collector's house at a blue, white, gray, and black geometric painting of a Cape Cod lighthouse.
I was puzzled by it. I was trying to figure out who it was by. I just had to know. When the owner told me, "Oh, that's Ida O'Keeffe, Georgia O'Keeffe's younger sister," I was, "What?"
Intrigued by Ida, the curator began a quest to uncover the story of a forgotten artist. Canterbury compares it to resurrecting the dead. The art and information she's amassed debuted last year at the Dallas Museum of Art, where Canterbury works. Now the show, Ida O'Keeffe, Escaping Georgia's Shadow, is at the Clark. It begins in the 1920s with snapshots taken by pioneering photographer Alfred Stieglitz. Ida and Georgia spent time together at his Lake George retreat. In one picture, both sisters smile happily.
That's not the usually imperious Georgia that one recalls, you know, cool and calm and severe looking.
Stieglitz would marry Georgia in a few months, but Canterbury says he flirted relentlessly with Ida in the fall of 1924, which Georgia laughed off. Then the curator points to a photo with a very different vibe.
Georgia staring straight down the barrel of Stieglitz's lens, very hard looking, and Ida next to her is just, you know, looking to the side and looks a little bit unsure. And it almost just seems like the perfect symbol of what their relationship would become in a way.
Growing up, Ida and Georgia took art lessons with the same teachers. Georgia studied painting with Charles Martin at Columbia. Years later, Ida did too. But in 1933, when Ida wanted to exhibit in New York, Georgia told her she better not.
Ida refused to stop exhibiting, and even though they've been close, they became absolutely estranged after that.
Canterbury thinks Georgia felt her sister was riding on her coattails. Some people thought the same about Georgia and her influential husband, Stieglitz.
He helped guide her, and then he introduced her to the right critics and the collectors, helped increase the value of her art, develop her brand into becoming the mother of American modernism.
Canterbury plowed through biographies about Georgia, searching for leads about Ida. Eventually, she asked the public for help through crowdsourcing. People came forward with letters, artwork, and Ida's professional scrapbook. It's stuffed with reviews of her art and articles about her taking yet another faculty teaching job. Canterbury recalls a headline from San Antonio, where Ida taught from 1938 to 39.
It says, "Artist sister joins Lady of Lake faculty." Everywhere she went, she was always introduced through the aura of her sister. It was never having this chance to stand on her own.
Sometimes Ida dropped the name O'Keeffe for exhibitions. She also distinguished herself through her art, experimenting with symmetry, abstract form, and monotypes, which Canterbury says helped make her money during the Depression. Unlike her sister, Ida never married. She also never had a dealer.
Women could not get that unless you were under the wing of a man, like Stieglitz, for instance. And so Georgia's situation is one that is so exceptional. It was a situation that 99.99% of the other women artists didn't get.
This was not lost on Georgia's sister.
I'd at one point say, well, I'd be famous too if I'd had a Stieglitz.
The O'Keeffe sisters never reconciled before Ida died in 1961. Canterbury hopes people who visit the exhibition will walk away thinking about all the unsung women artists out there and about how many are ripe for rediscovery. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
And to see some of Ida's artwork, go to hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.